You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of the Montreal Mafia Murders by Adam Leith Gulmer, with illustrations by Nicole Rifkin. The mayor of Saint-Jude told reporters that he fell off his chair when he learned that two seemingly upstanding locals had been accused of such nightmarish undertakings. It shows you never really know people you think you know. Like real-life characters from Fargo, Vio and Dion had gotten all mixed up with killers for hire. What prosecutors wanted to know was, were the husband and wife merely rubes who'd been duped into participating in the gruesome homicides, or had they cooperated knowingly and willingly? Seeking teeth, bone fragments, and other traces of the victims, investigators started combing through their yard, their garage, and the quiet stream across the street. The murder cycle. 3.5 years earlier, on May 27, 2016, Rocco Sauce Solicito got into his BMW for the very last time. The 67-year-old director of operations for Montreal's Sicilian Mafia drove through the parking lot of his luxury condo complex, wads of hundreds bulging in his pockets. The chopard on his wrist caught the morning light, showing exactly 8:30. From across the street, a lookout on a motorcycle tracked the BMW. His helmet's dark visor shielded his face. When he saw Consigliere Solicito steering onto the boulevard, the man on the speed bike raced ahead, cueing other members of his crew to get into position. A black Acura then sliced in front of the BMW. At the next stop sign, the Acura braked to a full halt, blocking the way for several seconds, long enough for Solicito to notice a man with a motorcycle helmet at the bus shelter to his right. The man pulled out a 9mm Taurus handgun. Solicito didn't try to escape. He didn't ram the Acura. He simply watched as the man approached and began firing through the passenger side window. "I emptied the loading clip into him," the gunman later recounted. "He ate it all." One of the 9 hollow-point bullets ripped Solicito's heart apart, killing him. The Acura veered off while the assassin fled around the corner to join the motorcyclist who'd sped by a minute earlier. He jumped onto the bike's back seat, and the two men headed into the crisp spring air. By the time police and paramedics arrived, the culprits had evaporated. "It's not complicated. It's a mob hit," a police spokesperson said in the aftermath. "It was clinical. No DNA. No usable clues." But Solicito was a highly symbolic casualty in the war between Montreal's Sicilian mafiosi and their Calabrian counterparts. The Calis, as the city's Calabrese crooks call themselves, were suddenly poised to seize control of a vast underworld operation connected to New York, Latin America, and the Old Country. Whoever killed Solicito would be sure to gain the respect of 'Ndrangheta, the most extensive and powerful criminal organization in the world, as Interpol calls the group. 'Ndrangheta, based in Calabria, operates in dozens of countries and generates $50 billion per year. Its chief stronghold outside Italy is Canada, where Ontario's Camera di Controllo makes decisions affecting an entire global network. Montreal, however, had long eluded 'Ndrangheta's grasp. According to Italy's anti-mafia brigade, for decades, Montreal has been the key that turns the lock of America. Since 1980 or so, the kingpins with the keys had been the Stitches, as the city's Sicilian faction is known. Before then, going back to the era of Lucky Luciano and the so-called French Connection, Calabrians ran the books. But in the late 1970s, they'd been forced to hand things over after a blood feud with the Stitches. And wiping out Solicito was part of a vendetta intended to reverse that defeat. As Solicito's murderers would later explain, the goal of the Calabrians was to get rid of all the Sicilians, take the power, and prevent them from getting back on their feet. That hitman's name has been under a court-ordered publication ban since he became an informant and entered witness protection in 2019. His street name, though, the Frenchman, refers to the fact that, despite working for the mob, he isn't Sicilian or Calabrian. He's a weed-blazing Quebecer. The Frenchman's undercover recordings have shed lurid light on the mafia's worldwide narco-trafficking networks, revealing battles between clan members stretching from the hilltops of southern Italy and drug production regions to cities across North America, even to rural homes like Vio and Dion's. For this story, Vanity Fair was granted access to those shocking audio files, portions of which are reproduced verbatim. The evidence collected by the Frenchman and touted as a major breakthrough by the Canadian justice system, as well as courtroom testimony and investigators' tape recordings, have so far resulted in two life sentences, with more trials to come. Alongside Vio and Dion, the other star defendant has been the alleged motorcycle driver from the Solicito escapade, a 41-year-old capo for the Callies, who dated Vio's younger sister during the crime war. The Frenchman describes him as the big cockroach. That capo's name has also been under publication ban, so for the purposes of this story, he would be called Foti. But court documents and local French language media have referred to him by the alias that he gave when he signed up for a burner phone right before Solicito's death, Brad Pitt. The menu. Foti and the Frenchman bolted away from the blood-soaked BMW on the motorbike. Cop cars, meanwhile, barreled past them toward the crime scene. Looking up, the two riders spotted helicopters in the sky. They braced against the wind, certain they'd get caught, but no one stopped them. Earlier that morning, in fact, the duo had a close call with police at a garage in the suburbs north of Montreal. Around 5 a.m., as they'd been preparing for the hit at their stash house, they were picking out guns, toys, as they called them. Foti started posing with a piece like De Niro in a Scorsese film. "Don't do that," the Frenchman growled, as Foti pulled the slide and aimed at some imaginary target. Losing patience, the Frenchman told him again to stop playing around. At that moment, the gun accidentally went off, and a bullet blasted into the wall. "Idiot," the Frenchman seethed, opening the garage door. They rolled out the motorcycle and revved the engine. Just then, a patrol car coasted by, windows open. It slowed so that two cops could look them over in the dawn light. The hitmen stood there in the driveway, trying to act normal. Gunfire at that bleary hour, in a quiet residential neighborhood. No matter, seemingly satisfied that the sound had conceivably been a motorbike backfiring, the officers went on their way. According to prosecutors, Foti was, at that point, a getaway man. His cohorts saw him as calculating, with commendable skills in manipulation and flattery, but he tended to be shaky in stressful situations. Yes, Foti claimed he'd previously killed someone on the street, and yet his higher-ups wanted him to make his bones, to be the gunman in a premeditated hit. Once he did so, he'd be promoted to capo. He'd been psyching himself up when the toy went off. He spoke with a bro-inflected North Shore accent, punctuating his comments with cusses like menagia, damn, or minkia, male sex organ. The Frenchman, on the other hand, swore in Quebecois blasphemies, "Tabernacle," an expletive that literally means tabernacle, but serves as the equivalent of the F-word. He consumed steroids and stupendous amounts of marijuana, often 2 ounces or more per day. Despite living with myriad conditions, bipolar 2, severe attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, complex post-traumatic stress disorder, borderline personality disorder, his mind could focus under pressure. Diagnosed with an antisocial personality marked by narcissistic grandiosity and paranoia, he saw himself, as he would state in one tape-recorded conversation, as a chess player and not a lobotomized partridge. He talked ridiculously fast. Foti, too, was a motor mouth. Together, their lingo was full of references both filmic and gnomic. To them, a contracted killing, such as Solicitos, was codenamed a cannoli, in homage to a now-classic scene from The Godfather. To assassinate someone was to eat them or pepper them. A hired gun pulling the trigger was a squeezer. The list of foes to be drilled with specific price tags on their heads was the menu. When we do a hit, we say we're going to go eat, go to the restaurant, testified the Frenchman. That's what the menu was for us. Menus were shared among the gang via encrypted devices called boxes, usually BlackBerry pagers. These to-do lists came from the table, composed of senior mafia members. The job that morning had been advertised as a $300,000 meal. But collecting payment for cannolis isn't simple, as Foti and the Frenchman were about to learn. Next illustration shows a bonfire in the yard of a rural home. The farmhouse. After ditching the bike in the stash house garage, the two drove Foti's car to Vio and Dion's backwoods home in Saint-Jude, an hour away. The mobsters went there to wash up, lose the murder weapon, and burn their clothes. The couple in the woods had only gotten to know Foti recently, but he was already luring them into his web. They met through Vio's 2 younger siblings. Her brother, Martin Vio, had been in jail with Foti and the Frenchman. Conspiracy, gangsterism, and drug trafficking for Foti, aggravated assault for the Frenchman. Foti was looking for a woman on the outside, someone who could help him start over. Martin suggested to his sister, Stephanie Vio, that she might make a good match for Foti. Stephanie began visiting him in the slammer. When he got out, they dated and moved in together in the late summer or early fall of 2015. The couple spent time hanging out with Vio and Dion. They talked, dined, enjoyed each other's company. Foti soon made his move. He asked them if he could borrow $10,000, offering to pay back $1,000 a month plus $1,000 for interest. "This doesn't smell good," Vio told her husband. Despite their apprehensions, they loaned Foti the funds in February 2016. The bad smell soon turned fetid. At the outset, Foti paid the monthly $1,000. He stopped doing so by May, the month of Solicito's murder. He then altered the deal's terms. He would give them an extra $1,000 a month to store tools in the crawl space above their sprawling garage. Those tools ended up being hockey bags full of pistols, submachine guns, explosives, and ammo. Foti got them a dedicated BlackBerry pager. His contact name in the device was Bag of Nails. The arsenal in the garage soon became so extensive that when Vio prepared an inventory, it ran to 36 pages. "I could have gone to war with that man," she marveled. They could have also tried to back out, many times. But incredibly, as Vio explained in the undercover recordings, she harbored aspirations of being part of this outlaw life, of actually joining the mafia in some capacity. Torn between trepidation and excitement, she'd imagined an escape from a lifetime of drudgery. "I want to be around the table," she confided to the Frenchman, bringing up her Italian heritage. "I was raised that way by my grandmother. We Fantalonis and Garlucis. My family had honor. I want that honor to be reestablished." On the day of Solicito's murder, Dion was at home, but as Vio originally told police, and as the Frenchman testified in court, she was there. and assisted the killers, building a fire in a metal canister on her lawn. The two men burned their outfits, including shoes and helmets. Foti then jumped into the above-ground pool while the Frenchman showered, rinsing off any gunshot residue. After changing into fresh clothing, they promised her they'd return soon to sell some of the contents of the hockey bags. When news of the murder broke on TV, the two men high-fived. It was time to get paid. Splitting the pie, Salvatore Scopa greeted Foti with a tight hug. "More to come," he bellowed, laughing, as he always did when his henchmen killed someone. A hulking musclehead known to his cronies as Mental, Sal Scopa was big in the Calabrian mob. His brother Andrew Scopa would soon be considered by law enforcement as the presumed acting boss of the Montreal Mafia. It was Sal, however, who'd ordered that morning's cannoli on Rocco Solicito, and he congratulated Foti and the Frenchman. They were gathered at Piatti, a marble-stone pizza pasta spot near the intersection where Solicito had been slain hours earlier. Also at the table was the Acura driver, a quiet, skinny, Calabrian squeezer nicknamed Sigmund. He lived with his mother. In the lead-up to the crime, the group had contemplated dressing up as postmen or pretending to direct traffic. But the Frenchman had vetoed those scenarios. "We don't do no cowboy stuff." At Piatti, Scopa, pleased with the result, told them that he had an offer to make. They could either split $100,000 in cash, or they could take $50,000 and 10% of his territory. That turf was worth $2 million in annual drug sales and pizzo, protection money. The Frenchmen couldn't believe it, contending they'd been promised much more for the job. "You're an effing pig," he snarled, standing up at the table and reaching for a steak knife. "It was supposed to be $300K plus 10% for killing Rocco." "Shh," replied Scopa, as the others tried to get the manic Frenchman to sit back down. The Frenchman was losing it, spiraling. He'd thought that peppering Solicito would provide a rush of release. Instead, he could feel the whole deal slipping from his grasp. Scopa, he believed, was stiffing the gang, plain and simple. In the Frenchman's courtroom accounts of that moment, everything became a blur, a Hitchcockian dream sequence, violin stabs and all. By sheer cosmic coincidence, another wise guy in the stitches, Tony the florist, whose name was on the Calabrian's menu for an upcoming cannoli, just happened to be seated across the room. The Frenchman, known for habitually smoking too much hashish, lost his focus. He pivoted his attention toward Tony the florist and the purported $150,000 bounty on his head. The Frenchman started talking about getting a gun. "I killed one person today," he ranted, "and I'm going to kill another right now. I don't give an F." He was ready then and there to plant geraniums in the florist cranium. As the Frenchman would tell the tale in court, it seemed like an act, as though he were in some kind of stage troupe, putting on a Polly Walnuts-like performance. Echoing tropes from the gangland movies they loved, the others reminded him in whispers that even if he did pluck the florist petals, he'd have to share the $150,000 with them. As accomplices, they'd all be eating from the pie. "Italians are the masters of betrayal," piped up Sigmund, the Acura driver. "Treachery, it's the DNA. Stitches and snitches. Sal and Andrew Scopa, both of Calabrian extraction, came up in Montreal's Sicilian mob under Godfather Vito Rizzuto, whose decades-long reign ended when he passed away in 2013, evidently of natural causes. Rizzuto had hailed from the Cosa Nostra hotbed of Sicily's Agrigento province. He led Montreal's organization known as the Stitches, or the Sixth Family, due to its interconnectedness with New York's Five Families. Italian court documents depicted Rizzuto as a global superboss who created a transnational society linking Italian clans with overseas cells. Clandestine recordings of mafiosa in Palermo captured discussions of how Rizzuto in Montreal makes the effing rules. An associate in Sicily conveying his proximity to Rizzuto was recorded as saying, "I sit at the right hand of God." Rizzuto used humbler terms. "People come to me to solve disputes," he told one Quebec journalist. Able to broker peace between rivals, he saw himself as a mediator. In reality, he was a dapper underworld diplomat whose conflict resolution skills had far-reaching consequences. In 2005, when a $6 billion suspension bridge connecting Sicily to Calabria was set to be built, Italy's Direzione Investigativa Antimafia revealed that the consortium bidding to finance the construction was covertly being overseen by Rizzuto. The bridge was never built, nor was his Italian arrest warrant enforced, as he would soon be extradited to the U.S. for participating in the 1981 murders of three Buonanno family captains. During the 6 years he spent in a Colorado supermax prison, numerous members of his circle, including his father and his eldest son, were killed. The Scopa brothers remained loyal to the Rizzuto family throughout Vito's imprisonment. And shortly before his release in 2012, the New York Post reported that Rizzuto's stated aim was to be godfather of the world. Upon returning home, the Don conferred with Andrew Scopa, who hoped to become his right-hand man, according to a recent book, Inside the Montreal Mafia, by Eric Thibault and Félix Séguin. But the Stitches decided on a new management structure, with Rocco Solicito's son and one of Vito Rizzuto's sons at the top. Andrew was out. Andrew's brother Sal stayed on as one of the Stitches' squeezers. His signature move, the Frenchman testified, was to submerge foes in a bathtub full of acid and watch them melt. In the summer of 2015, the Sicilian table decided that Sal, however, had become a snitch and had to be liquidated. When Sal found out, he vowed revenge, with Foti as his operations guy. Their first hit came in September 2015, when they killed an up-and-coming member of the Stitches. 6 weeks later, before the Solicito Rizzutos could respond, their leaders were arrested in a crackdown. People wanted anyone tempted to take their place to know they were being monitored. The Scopa brothers didn't care. They were a new Andrina, as Calabrians call, a blood-related unit that rises to take over a city, and they had declared war. Next illustration, the killer returns. After 3 years of silence, the Frenchman shockingly reappeared at Vio's out-of-the-way restaurant. A love triangle and some hockey bags. Vio and Dion, meanwhile, were getting on with their lives in Saint-Jude, and Foti was increasingly becoming part of the decor, as Vio put it. Foti would come over for occasional dinners. One time, they all attended a tractor-pulling event somewhere in the sticks. Another time, Foti showed up in a panic because he'd somehow messed up and angered his bosses in the Calabrian mob. Dion kept up his firefighting job while taking on occasional asphalting projects. He was a steady-state steak-and-potatoes homebody, happiest when doing repairs around their 100-year-old house or tooling around on his ATV. At one point, Foti arranged for Dion to be Sal Scopa's bodyguard at the boss's son's baptism, a $500 gig. Then came the ill-fated $10,000 loan, which was steep for Vio and Dion. When they'd purchased their $7,000 hot tub, they'd had to save up for 18 months in order to afford it. Vio, despite a degree in civil engineering, couldn't manage to land a skilled position. Instead, she was resigned to working night shifts at the restaurant, finishing at 7 a.m. before driving an hour back to Saint-Jude. She'd considered opening a bar, but that fell through. When Foti met her, she'd been constantly questioning herself over her lack of options. "What am I doing?" she asked her husband at one point, wondering if she was having a midlife crisis at 41. She felt like a pawn, which is exactly how the Kallis would end up using her. It's impossible to say with certainty how much she understood of Foti's world, but Mafia books were found in her possession, so she obviously knew she was flirting with fire. As her younger sister, Stephanie, Foti's girlfriend, reminded her, if you want to play in the big leagues, there are consequences. Marie-José brushed those concerns aside. At that point, the Frenchman was still in prison. When he came up for parole, an evaluation deemed him a significant risk for recidivism. The authorities recommended he be kept under observance at a halfway house. The day before his transfer, two fellow inmates jumped him. Badly beaten, he showed up to the transitional home with stitches on his face. The probation agent assigned to his case turned out to be an attractive 22-year-old officer called Noemi. Under Canadian law, her real name can't be published. She comes to bring me my clothes, my box, and she stares me down right in the face, he testified. She bends down without even leaving my eyes, so I say, uh-oh, trouble. Noemi's duties included physically escorting him outside the grounds on errands, like shopping for groceries. The two soon began seeing each other discreetly. He'd only had one serious girlfriend before, whereas Noemi, so he claimed, was a hypersexual swinger. Their relationship continued, until another detainee, who happened to be the same height and build, was gunned down outside the home. The Frenchman had been the target, as retribution for a crooked deal involving the Sinaloa cartel, but they sprayed the wrong guy. In the ensuing investigation, when police discovered the Frenchman had been sleeping with his intervention officer, his parole was revoked. Locked up again, he asked Noemi to collect money owed to him by Foti. She did, and Noemi and Foti then apparently started an affair, without the Frenchman knowing. When the Frenchman finally got out for good, in April 2016, he moved in with Noemi. At that time, Foti introduced the Frenchman to Sal Scopa, suggesting he be the boss's driver and bodyguard, his salami in their parlance. The Frenchman said he'd do whatever Scopa wanted. I'll be loyal to you like a Taliban to his faith, he told him. To the end, I'm all in. He became a squeezer, and after they'd terminated Solicito, Scopa told Foti it was time that he too became a proper hitter. If he did a good job, Scopa promised, he'd make Foti his underboss, his capo. The list of people the Scopas wanted dead was long. It included figures like Lieutenant Lorenzo the Skunk Giordano and others in the stitches. The Calabrese wanted to clean them all out, the Frenchman explained under oath. In the type of jungle they're in, you eat them all or you eat nothing. Next up on the menu were two brothers in their 20s, Joey and Vinny Falduto. Vinny had just gotten out of jail, and according to Calabrian intel, was a hitman working for the Sicilians. The brothers were reputedly pursuing a crook known as Fatso, with a $400,000 sticker on his forehead. Since both the Kallis and the Stitches wanted Fatso dead, Foti offered to help the Faldutos do the job as a means of trapping them. The idea was to bring the brothers to Vio and Dion's farmhouse to sample the goods in the hockey bags and then whack them both. Vio and Dion supposedly knew nothing about the whacking. All they'd been told, they would later claim, was that prospective buyers for the gun stash were coming over to fire off test rounds before agreeing on a deal for the merchandise. The couple had been instructed to make a racket so that neighbors wouldn't hear any gunfire. On that day, in mid-June 2016, Vio had music blasting. Dion was on his tractor. First, the Faldutos perused the cash. Glocks, .357 Magnums, .22-caliber rifles. They then went outside and started shooting into the ground next to the garage, which was Foti's signal to do the deed. Instead, he seized up. The Frenchman glared at him, but Foti couldn't go through with it. After some awkward talk, Foti decided to lend them his car, so they'd have a pretext for seeing each other again. The Faldutos also took a Mac 10 with a silencer, a sausage, they called it, for Fatso. Make the bodies disappear. 2 weeks later, on June 30th, 2016, the Faldutos returned to Saint-Jude. The couple, as agreed, was making the usual din. The day before, according to the body pack recordings, Vio had brought Foti 4 boxes of hollow point bullets from the hockey bags. The Frenchman relished hollow points, which flare open on impact. They mushroom, he noted. They don't pass through the body, they stay in. When the two cars pulled into the driveway of the country home, the radio was outside, hanging from a tree, its volume knob cranked to the max. The tractor was running in the background, and Dion was cutting down trees with a chainsaw. It's like a B-movie, the Frenchman would recall. The Faldutos entered the 3-door garage. Vio watched through her front window. Walking in, the Frenchman looked pointedly at Foti. Let's do this. Foti just stood there, frozen. He had his gun, but, again, he couldn't pull the trigger. The Frenchman, seeing Foti choke, whipped out his piece. He shot Vinny first in the head, then Joey in the back as he tried to run. The Frenchman jumped over the trunk of the car to finish Joey off, then turned back to Vinny. A hollow point was coming out of half his face like an effing thing from a Halloween movie. When the gunshots died down, Foti started crying. They'd killed 2 young men for nothing, for some money. Dion rushed in, alarmed by the commotion. They got him to fetch a roll of plastic. Vio brought cleaning supplies. The Frenchman instructed her to sponge the blood rather than wipe it up. Otherwise, the blood residue will stay. Foti looked at him, trembling. How are you staying so calm? If we get excited, we're going to make mistakes. As he and Dion rolled one of the corpses onto a sheet of plastic, it suddenly moved. The Frenchman jumped. But it was just dead nerves causing electrochemical twitches. Dion, who lived around farm animals and abattoirs, continued wrapping the bodies in disconcerting silence. Foti then told the dumbfounded couple they would need to get rid of everything. How? They'd figure it out. They were to bring the car to a guy named Guido. He'd scrap it. And like that, the 2 hitmen left. Dion looked at his wife. What were they supposed to do with the bodies? She wasn't sure. Had she or they said something about making them disappear? She tried the bag of nails pager. Foti didn't respond, nor did he contact her that evening or the next day. In the end, Foti never came back and never brought them another penny. They were stuck with the debt he owed them and with the bodies, a double-double. They'd known something was going to happen, but not like this, not in their garage, not with a mob ghosting them. As Vio put it, there was no after. The gang that couldn't shoot straight. 3 years later, on July 4th, 2019, the Frenchman pulled up to a rural La Belle Provence restaurant at sunset. He ordered a poutine and a double cheeseburger, then asked the cashier if she recognized him. His face said something to her, but she wasn't sure what. He'd lost weight, he conceded. He'd started dyeing the gray out. It's been a while since then, with the fireman, he offered. I was at your place a few times with Foti, the Italians. Oh, Lord, she gasped. Vio had closed that chapter of her life. Dion and she never spoke about it. Someone had come at some point to take the weapons in the bag of nails box, and that had been that. She'd kept on making hot dogs and fries. But now the killer had suddenly reappeared, like a hare in the soup, as she put it. The two sat in a booth and talked for 2 hours. He'd had a rough time since they'd last met. Knives in my back from every direction, he said. She understood. In the intervening years, she said, she hadn't spoken to Foti or her sister Stephanie. Foti had officially been promoted to capo after the Falduto brothers were murdered. As the Frenchman explained to Vio at La Belle Provence, and as he would later testify at her trial, Foti then tried to kill him several times to silence him. According to the Frenchman, the Collies had always missed or bungled things, the gang that couldn't shoot straight, he called them. Noemi, even though she'd lived with the Frenchman then, had been in on the assassination attempts, he claimed, and conspired with Foti to do him in. Whether or not Noemi was actually involved in any plot, this much was certain. She left the Frenchman on Christmas night, 2016. Stephanie and Foti had also broken up by then. At first, it looked like the Collies had accomplished their goal. After the Faldutos' ambush, they'd wrested control of the city's mob operations, and Sal Scopa promptly flew to Calabria for meetings. That fall, Canadian law enforcement learned that the Scopas had received the backing of Italian crime syndicates and were the current leaders of the Montreal Mafia. Their hold on power, however, was far from secure. In September 2016, Andrew Scopa was recorded by police telling his driver, "It's hard to stay on top. It's a new world, champ. Everybody wants to take your belt." A month later, when Andrew was arrested on narcotics charges, the Collies imploded. They turned on each other, from the top dogs to the flunkies. "A scrumble," Foti called it on one of the body pack recordings. "Everybody was paranoiding with each other. Nobody went to see nobody. Everybody became crazy." It was during that time that Foti allegedly added the Frenchman to the menu. According to the Frenchman, Foti also wanted to kill Vio and Dion and burn their property down. When his underlings botched a hit, mistakenly slaying a Stitch's father instead of the son, Sal Scopa put Foti in the hospital. "Like a ping-pong ball he was throwing me," was how Foti put it. "The chandelier got ripped down. He's hitting me with the chandelier." Per the Frenchman's account, Foti then did his best to shut Sal's lights. When a rival hitman shot at Sal in the winter of 2017, injuring but not killing him, Foti was on the premises. On that summer evening, La Belle Provence, the Frenchman's stories had the effect of making Vio open up about the Faldutos. Her shoes had been drenched in blood, she disclosed. To clean the garage, she'd emptied 8 containers of bleach. "Our eyes were burning," she said. They'd used 3 sets of saw blades to grind the murder weapons into tiny pieces, which they'd tossed while driving around the countryside. They dumped the loaner car with a man named Gadou and never heard from him again. "What about the bodies?" "I did everything like a good soldier," she assured him. "We burned everything. It had taken 6 cords of wood, enough to heat a large home for an entire Canadian winter, and 4 cans of gas." The bonfire raged for an entire day. They'd even needed to cut down more trees in the middle of the night. "You don't understand," she went on. "They weren't burning, man. I took the pickaxe with the shovel to go in. Listen, my heart was bawling. The pickaxe to open them up." Guy's seen people burn because he's a fireman. He never burned anyone. Even so, the two of them got it done. "Me, I'm the brains," she said. "He's the muscle." In the aftermath, they dug up that section of the ground 1 foot deep because of the oils and the this and the that, then refilled it with other soil. They threw the cinders and whatnot into the river. She'd known how to take care of business. "Deal with it. Thank you. Good night. Don't talk about it again. It's over." But what did they get for it? "If all," she said. "Not even a visit. Nothing. Niet. Nada." Catch and release. Over the next 2 months, the Frenchman visited Vio and Dion several times. He also reconnected with Sigmund, the Acura driver, who'd been hiding out with his mother. Foti, to their knowledge, was also underground. But then, on September 10, 2019, the Sûreté de Québec released photographs from 3 years earlier showing Solicito's two killers on their motorcycle. They broadcast the images on social media and news outlets, requesting assistance in identifying the suspects. That morning, the Frenchman found Sigmund at his usual hangout, Café Red Room, having breakfast. "Did you see the news today?" He thrust his phone toward his compagne. "Look at this, asshole." Sigmund squinted at the screen. "If they're asking the public for help, it means they have nothing," he argued. "They're fishing." "No, this is the effing game they do. It's catch and release," countered the Frenchman. "They have info." He knew Foti still had the motorcycle. He also knew that he and his father were laying tiles at a Sheraton just north of Montreal, not far from Solicito's murder site. It was the same hotel where several months earlier Sal Scopa had finally been cannolied, shot dead in the crowded lobby on the night of his son's first Holy Communion. "We're going to talk to Foti," the Frenchman decided, despite the handful of times Foti had supposedly tried to have him killed. "Tell him you have to get rid of the bike. Chop it. They're looking for the effing bike." He and Sigmund beelined it to the Sheraton. The Frenchman had made it a point to wear a tank top, shorts, and flip-flops, so nobody would worry about getting whacked. "If they see me all geared up, they're going to think I'm the effing messenger of death," he told Sigmund. They arrived around 9:30 a.m. "What's going on?" Foti's father asked, flustered. Foti looked up from his work as the two hitmen approached. "We're all cool," he asked nervously. "No contract on me?" "You're safe, Jesus Christ," said the Frenchman, gesturing to his outfit, then bringing out the police notice. "Come on, look at this." "When did that come out?" Foti asked. "This morning, bro," replied the Frenchman, adding that it was all over TV and Twitter. Seeking privacy, they huddled at the hotel's rear loading dock area. "But why now, this thing, why now?" Foti wanted to know. "Telling each other not to freak out. None of us are hot." They examined the facts. The cops were looking for two unidentifiable individuals and a motorcycle. "You know how many motorcycles there are," argued the father. Foti conceded that he still had the bike, but he'd changed its parts, so no cops would be able to identify it. "Are you a ding-dong or what?" asked the Frenchman. "You have to destroy it," Sigmund insisted. Foti tried to reassure them. "This is the triangle right here, right? As long as we keep our mouths shut, we're good." There were others, though, namely the fireman and the cleanup woman. He'd paid them, right? "I don't have that kind of money," Foti protested. "Sal never gave it to me. What am I supposed to do?" "What about the weapons from their garage? I swear on my mother's head I have every bullet and every effing gun," Foti said. As they spoke, he suddenly realized the urgent need to get rid of them, too. "Pa," he cried out, "it's all under my name, Pa. Imagine something goes wrong. They're going to put me away for 100 years. They decided the Frenchman would retrieve the hockey bags from Foti's storage locker and sell whatever he could. "We split everything," he said. "Me, you, him, and Marie-José. Everything down the line, fair and square." The two assassins drove off and debriefed. Foti would trash the bike. They would move the weapons. "Foti was a different person," the Frenchman told Sigmund. "He knows he made a mistake with you and me." "He got more relaxed as we started talking," Sigmund said. "He was honest about a few things, except about him trying to whack me. Foti had, that morning, denied being behind those attempted hits." "Yeah," mumbled Sigmund, who remembered when the Collies had asked him to take out the Frenchman. "The only reason you didn't go down is because of me," Sigmund confessed, explaining that he, too, had been part of the plan to whack the Frenchman. "I couldn't do it. I couldn't understand it. It's breaking a code within me. To start betraying each other and the gang? No. No, no, no. It's not going to end up good." The Frenchman, it so happened, had been betraying the gang for months. He'd approached the police to become an informant, and when they first heard his tale, it seemed so extraordinary, full of so many ludicrous blow-ups, they scarcely believed it. A sergeant detective named Dacky Termidor spent weeks cross-referencing related murders to corroborate the facts. Termidor determined that the Frenchman's claims were true. As an undercover agent, the Frenchman agreed to wear body pack equipment to capture others inculpating themselves. Termidor oversaw the descriptions of those conversations, portions of which read like dialogue from a Coen Brothers screenplay. After the Belle Provence encounter and the Sheraton summit, Termidor's colleagues retrieved the cache of weapons from Foti's storage locker. More than 100 officers worked on the case, which was dubbed Project Premeditate. On October 16, 2019, police arrested Foti, Sigmund, Dion, and Vio. 5 days later, Andrew Scopa was killed, shot in the face in a strip mall parking lot. Based largely on the body pack recordings, Sigmund was sentenced to life on 2 counts of first-degree murder and of conspiracy to commit murder. He has appealed. In those tapes, Sigmund spoke of the fate he saw awaiting Foti, an ugly death, as he put it. Andrew Scopa, before his own grim demise, shared that opinion. It's not going to end up good. The Frenchman, despite 3 murders and a lifetime of crime, got a handsome haul to turn state's evidence. $450,000, plus lodging and a weekly stipend, ostensibly for his marijuana consumption. Pressed about his drug usage on the stand, he admitted having a $1,000-per-week habit. He also testified that he occasionally microdosed hallucinogenic mushrooms, claiming they relieved his flashbacks. "I'm in the middle of reliving each experience I describe here. I dream it as though it were the moment itself." Compared to the others, he seemingly had it made. But for all that, the Frenchman couldn't help ending up back in jail, in this case, for allegedly harassing members of the police, as well as Noemi. Convinced that she and Foti had tried to have him killed, he'd wanted her arrested for attempted murder. He grew obsessed, claiming the police had promised to investigate her as part of his compensation package. They refused to charge her. Noemi had a restraining order placed against him. He then ended up being the one charged for making death threats. When a defense attorney implied that he might be an unreliable witness because of payments he received, he snapped. "This was for vengeance. It wasn't for money. You understand English or French? I did it for the effing vengeance." The secret of the gods. Vio and Dion's trial took place in a high-security judicial center attached via underground tunnels to Montreal's Bordeaux prison. Throughout the winter of the trial, as cross-examinations stretched on, snow squalls turned the sky the same grayish-white as the icy ground, creating the effect that the courthouse was floating in a kind of mist. Vio and Dion both chose to testify, insisting that, fearing for their lives, they'd lied in those scabrous recordings. They hadn't actually burned the bodies, they told the court. They'd made that up, so the mafia wouldn't think they'd made mistakes. In reality, they said, they'd driven the car with the plastic-wrapped corpses in it to Guido's house and promptly left. The prosecution undermined that account, asking why, if Vio was afraid, had she looked out the kitchen window during the murder of the Faldutos? Why had she brought bullets to Foti? Why had she suggested having drinks with the Frenchman when he resurfaced? Why had she tried to hook him up with a friend or considered going into business together? She wept throughout the trial, folding and unfolding tissues, rotating them clockwise over and over. Dion, for his part, told the court that his now 18-year-long relationship with his wife had improved as a result of the homicide charges. "The fact that you were arrested for 2 murders is what improved your relationship?" the incredulous prosecutor asked him. "Yes," Dion replied, explaining that the ordeal had helped them start communicating more openly. Those born on New Year's Day, like Vio, 1975 in her case, are said to be lucky for life. But in the end, the jury found her guilty of conspiracy to commit murder and second-degree murder, bringing an automatic life sentence. Dionne was unexpectedly acquitted. She had claimed, after all, that she had been the brains. Dionne, ever the strong and silent type, hadn't said much on the recordings, whereas she had said far too much. Her testimony, the judge noted, strengthened the prosecution's already overwhelming evidence that established her involvement in the conspiracy to commit the murders and her participation in the murders by aiding and or abetting them. After the verdicts, Vanity Fair interviewed Crown Prosecutor Isabelle Poulin. Even if Vio were an accomplice to murder, did she actually deserve life behind bars while the actual squeezer walked free? "We believe justice followed its course," the prosecutor replied. Vio and her defense lawyer, Mylène Leroux, disagreed. They have appealed, but the court has yet to decide when, or even if, she will be retried. In yet another twist, Vio has been granted conditional liberty pending those proceedings. As she poses no security risk, the Court of Appeal ruled, and may ultimately be found innocent, a scenario the presiding judge described as realistic, she is presumed to be living once again at the family home in Saint-Jude. Last fall, Foti stood trial for the 2016 murders of Rocco Solicito, the Falduto brothers, and yet another member of the Stitches. When the Frenchman testified against Foti, he couldn't hold back from calling his former partner names: rat, imbecile, cockroach. Moreover, he accused him of various other crimes, the precise details of which are under publication ban. Foti's defense team seized on the fact that the Frenchman presented inadmissible testimony in a prejudicial manner. The judge, for his part, declared a mistrial. A second trial for Foti was tentatively scheduled to begin in March. Whatever the ultimate verdicts, Foti undeniably led Vio down a tragic path. She has already been found guilty of murder, a conviction that will hang over her, Dionne, and their family for the rest of their lives, whether or not her appeal is successful. Still, it seems fair to wonder which version of her is the real one. At one point, while divulging the grisly details of the Falduto murders to a man she believed to be an underworld associate of the Frenchman's, actually an undercover cop, she leaned in and told him, while the tape machine was running, "You're stepping into the secret of the gods. You know your life is in danger. You know that I can do it. Don't be scared." But since her arrest, Vio has pleaded otherwise. "Christ, when I run over a baby cat, it takes me 4 days to get over it. I wouldn't go murder someone." This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selection by Mark Hoffman.